evolutionary trick is to evolve rapidly to avoid immune response.
Right.
So hence vaccinations are incredibly important.
So others believe that because there's no certainty around how the original antigenic sin of COVID will play out, moving forward and tweaking the vaccine for a new fall booster is the best course of action. COVID vaccine fall boosters are well underway and already being manufactured. Only time will tell how effective these new boosters will be.
And I'm actually recording this in California. Everyone around us here is already getting their vaccines. So get your fall boosters 2 months after you got your last booster. If you got your last booster months and months ago, go ahead and get your new one. And you can also get your coronavirus vaccine and your influenza vaccine at the same time.
I cannot wait. I'm actually taking my children to get their next dose, and then I'm going to get mine at the same time. So
excellent.
I'm very excited.
Good for you.
Thanks for listening to Noise Filter, your public health podcast.
Be sure to subscribe to the Noise Filter podcast, follow us on social media, and leave us a review letting us know your favorite part of the show.
You can find me, Hope Pickerson, at hopepickerson.com.
And you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at The Dr. Derry. That's D-R-D-E-R-Y.
To see and share our amazing animations and find out more information about us, the show, as well as links to our social media, go to noisefiltershow.com.
We are grateful to our sponsors, including Access Health Louisiana and the End the Epidemic Initiative, who are working to bring equitable health outcomes to everyone they serve. Hope, any last words?
Stay well out there, folks, and continue taking steps to keep yourself and your loved ones healthy. That includes exercise, a good diet, getting adequate sleep, and seeing your healthcare providers regularly.
And protect yourself and others by getting the COVID-19 vaccine and booster, wearing a mask, and social distancing wherever possible. Remember, health is a human right.
Supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO News is proud to present our 2022 Citizens Agenda Survey, and we want to hear your thoughts as we approach the midterm election. What do you want candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes? Let us know, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa gift card as a thank you. Plus, it will help our volunteer reporters cover the election with the info that you need to know. Find the survey online at bit.ly/KBOO-survey. That's KBOO's 2022 Citizens Agenda Survey, available online through September 25th at bit.ly/KBOO-survey.
Welcome to Labor Radio on KBOO Portland. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilliland.
Thank you so much for joining us. Just quickly before we begin our show, we would like to give a special thanks and shout out to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for hosting podcasts and versions of our show each month. Be sure to check that out at laborradionetwork.org. And now on to the topic we're going to be discussing tonight. You know, likely regardless of, you know, what industry you choose to scrutinize, a major theme that has been running throughout the simmering labor uprising that's spread across the country over the past couple years is that working people are fed up with employers' refusal to allow them any meaningful control over when and how they work. You know, we've seen such demands from hospital workers, from school teachers and school staff, and even from service workers at places like Amazon, Starbucks, and other, you know, frontline service workers like that. And last week, the same grievance very nearly brought America's system of rail transportation and, as a result, the entire supply chain to a grinding halt. You know, as early last Thursday, with the lockout deadline looming, two unions representing 125,000 American rail workers reached a tentative agreement with the major rail carriers in this country to avoid an all-out strike. Among other victories claimed, the union leaders said they succeeded in fighting off the rail carriers' efforts to impose higher healthcare costs and other damaging provisions. However, the contract still needs to be approved by the union rank-and-file membership, many of whom have actually expressed serious displeasure and concerns with the agreement itself. In fact, like one unnamed rail worker very bluntly told Labor Notes that, you know, quote, "It's a garbage deal. Everyone hates it so far. It's done nothing for me. I'll vote no. This has been a complete waste of time." So that's the sentiment where, you know, the rank and file are at. But that, you know, that's just one unnamed worker. It's hard to say whether or not that sentiment is widespread or if that's maybe in concentrated pockets throughout the industry. So obviously, like, this agreement may not mark the end of this this struggle for this contract negotiation and for the fate of our rail transportation network yet. But until the membership votes, it seems that a strike has been averted, at least for now.
Yeah, and, you know, we haven't covered it on the show, but back in July, Biden kind of put an extension. You know, they were about to reach the end of the talks previously, but he put an extension on it. So this really was kind of the ultimate deadline that was looming.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously we've heard some reports of kind of rank and file not being 100% into the deal. And obviously we'll go into more details, but many actually specifics of the deal were not released, and the leadership of kind of the largest unions that were a part of this has kind of come out and said they think it will pass.
Yeah.
So, you know, despite some of the kind of bubbling anxiety and kind of displeasure, it does seem like it's going to pass.
Yeah, it's a better position to be in than teetering on the brink of, you know, being locked out of your job, essentially.
Yeah. But like I said, I mean, you know, we haven't covered it up until this week on the show, but this has definitely been something that's been in negotiations for a long time. So, you know, anyone in rank and file who is upset, I can understand. This was a long, arduous effort for them while they were kind of continuing to work.
Yeah, while they were struggling to work under the conditions that we're going to describe here that led to all of this, essentially. But yeah, in light of the fact that it's still unsure as to whether or not this will be the final contract or whether it will continue to need to be negotiated, we'd like to talk today about what led us to this point and to dive into more of the specifics of the deal that has been tentatively agreed upon. So yeah, this strike threat came from the engineers and conductors who drive the nation's freight trains, a workforce that was deemed essential after the start of the pandemic and has been proven many times over to be very essential to our society. Unlike many other strike threats, the railroad workers' demands were not primarily actually about wages, but were rather focused on sick time and penalties for missing work. These workers are frequently penalized for taking days off when they're sick or tending to a family emergency. Now, to be clear, the workers also justifiably demanded a modest wage increase, because tens of thousands of American rail workers have actually gone for 3 years without a raise amid a contract dispute with these large freight carriers.
Yeah. No, and I think that touches on obviously a point that we you know, bring up many, many times on not our show, but kind of all of Labor Radio. And that's, again, strikes aren't always focused on wages, though obviously that was a part of it. And we'll dive into kind of the protections that the workers won for medical PTO. But in addition to that, also scheduling in yes. particular was a very big issue, which we'll touch on. And, you know, the workers on the railroads had been forced to be on call kind of at a moment's notice for basically years at this point,
yeah.
Which is not something that many people have to deal with in industries that, you know, we're also fighting kind of a lot of these fights. So
yeah.
In addition to that, it's not only when you are on time off, you're basically on call as well. And with all the supply chain issues, they were being called in frequently, according to like a lot of reports.
Right. And yeah, as we'll dive into too, like the workforce, you know, their brother and sister workers have dwindled too, as a result of the pandemic, but also as a result of specific industry decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, like these individual workers have been put upon more and more over the last few years, of the last decade and plus, really, but specifically in the pandemic era. And I think this is just sort of like a lot of them have reached the breaking point in a number of ways. But yeah, like the major grievances are actually centered, as Elliot was just saying, around days off and scheduling concerns, because conductors and engineers are basically told that, you know, they're continuously on call, and they are basically told to report to work and are typically given just 90 minutes to arrive at the work site without being penalized. So you have very little time to make it, you know, change your plans around. You know, maybe you're told you're on call, but you may not be, you know, necessarily ready to jump at that moment, and you have very little time to actually make it there and be ready to work. And their shifts can last up to 80 hours at a time. So, you know, like to be ready to go into an 8-hour day with, you know, an hour or like an hour and a half's notice is usually something that would be hard to be asked. But if you're being told you have to basically be ready to work for multiple days straight, that is, you know, for like a full week's worth of working time.
Yeah.
At, you know, given 2 hours to do so is a bit much. In fact, you know, one railroad worker explained that time doesn't actually, that does not include the time that you're sitting at the away from home terminal. So you might actually be away from home and subject to the railroad and not with your family for 120 hours in a week, which, you know, obviously I'm probably, you know, I'm missing something here, but like, I don't know a lot of other industries that ask that much of their employees without any type of set schedule or like, you know, permanent schedule. And at BNSF, which is the nation's largest rail carrier and also happens to be owned by Warren Buffett or Berkshire Hathaway, which is itself owned by Warren Buffett, the workers are subject to draconian point-based attendance systems, which result in them getting just one day off each month, which again seems insane. And like, of course these workers are, you know, have reached a breaking point. If you had one day off a month and you're expected to be ready to work for 120 hours a week, I mean, it's no surprise here. And as it turns out, this issue was the scheduling issue and the days off issue was the major sticking point in the negotiation process itself. According to Ellen Applebaum, who is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, quote, "Railroad management was intransigent on this point, a key union demand until President Biden got involved in the negotiations. Top brass at the railroads were willing to have a strike and plunge the nation into supply chain hell rather than grant this reasonable request." And a day prior to the tentative agreement was reached, Senator Bernie Sanders thankfully managed to block a Republican effort to force 115,000 rail workers to settle for a contract that did not include a single paid day off for sick leave. And that's kind of the big thing they were fighting for. So, yeah, there's still more details to come out about what exactly the Republicans were trying to do, but essentially they were siding fully with the management and completely against the workers, which is, you know, no surprise, but they wanted to basically avert the strike by forcing these workers to go back without any concessions. And, you know, as you may have actually likely noticed in your daily life, in the lead up to last Thursday's negotiation deadline, the major freight carriers began halting shipments and snarling the supply chain, in an effort to pressure Congress to impose a labor contract that was friendly to the management. So, you know, they were using their weapon at their disposal, which was throwing off our entire society, the entire economy, in order to basically threaten the American people and the representatives.
Yeah, but right before midterms.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the timing for them was quite strong. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, obviously, kind of politics aside, I mean, this is a pretty big win for Biden. Just the fact that they have kind of gone through this without arbitration or kind of Congress's involvement. Really, if this had gone negatively, there were only tons of horrible options available.
Yeah.
In order to protect the economy, right? Kind of at that point, you're talking like kind of macro level as opposed to like individual kind of workers, right? So, yeah, I mean, in terms of that, the actual White House, I think internally they're viewing this as like a gigantic win.
And, you know, rightfully so. I mean, yeah, as you were just saying, like if you know, if there was to be a shutdown of any elements of our transportation system, but specifically like freight rail, which of course, you know, we'll go into, but like would actually lead to a shutdown of passenger rail as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, like,
and people really vote. I mean, when the midterms pop up, you know, right? Like people are voting on the economy almost exclusively, right? Like people are upset about gas prices. If we were going into the midterms with a kind of an even more shuttered economy because of supply chain haltage, right? It would have been bad news bears.
Right, like that is already tainted at this point. You know, supply chain issues. It's almost a cliche at this point, but it's tainted basically the entire Biden presidency to this point. And so, you know,
oh, yeah.
From like a political standpoint, that would have been.
Yeah, I mean, and also, I mean, negotiations that Biden himself called into, right? So, I mean, right. the anti-campaign as right themselves, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, and so it is, you know, it is encouraging. It is an encouraging sign to see that.
And he ran as a union man, yeah. Right? So, again.
Not only a union man, but he also ran as like a rail man.
Yes.
He's a heavy train guy, you know?
Yeah.
Takes the Acela from Delaware to Washington all the time. So that's, you know, he's Biden his time on the rails and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. There's probably some more jokes in there, but
yeah,
we don't have time for that now. But yeah, this agreement that was reached basically grants railroad workers a single paid day off and the ability to attend medical appointments without penalty. So yeah, as I just said, a single paid day off per month, which is, you know, that's something, I guess. But, you know, of course, the unions had gone into the negotiations asking for 15 paid days per year. I misspoke earlier. It's a single paid day off per year. And they had asked for 15 paid sick days per year, which is, of course, the average among other OECD nations. So they came in asking for what is just basically the bare minimum standard around, you know, the developed or the, you know, the largest economies in the world, and instead we're given a fraction of that, a single day. So you can understand why the workers may have viewed this agreement as maybe not exactly what they were looking for, maybe frustrated at this point. But on top of that concession, the employers have also agreed to a 24% wage increase for the rail workers themselves. And you know, it could not have come sooner, or you know, it could not have come any later, because the deadline was basically at the end of the day and they agreed to it earlier in the day on Thursday. But a strike would have shut down nearly a third of the country's freight and about half of commuter rail systems, which, you know, the reason for that is because most commuter rail, specifically like Amtrak and other, you know, local options, they run at least partially and some, you know, way more so, on tracks or right-of-ways that are owned by freight railroads. You know, like most of the rail lines in this country are privately owned by these individual companies because they were all built by private interests back in, you know, the last or two centuries ago at this point. And so despite the fact that Amtrak does exist and is a national rail, passenger rail system, they don't actually own much of the right-of-way that they ride upon and are kind of at the mercy of these freight rail companies, which is why, you know, one of the major reasons why we don't have better passenger rail in this country, and why if you take a train, if you're taking like an Amtrak train farther than, you know, say from here to Eugene, you may end up waiting on sidetracks for a long time as freight rail, because they have the priority as they roll through. And so, yeah, a strike from rail workers, freight rail workers from these independent companies would trickle down to actually affecting the national passenger rail system that Amtrak operates. So that, of course, even though it isn't our primary mode of transportation, that would still be a major hindrance to the economy and to transportation around this country. So it would obviously, you know, this strike would have led to a huge slowdown and grinding halt for so many elements of our society, really. And yeah, it would have crippled our economy at a particularly vulnerable moment, as we've been discussing, with, you know, inflation still soaring. And in fact, actually, one rail worker was quoted as saying that he said, quote, "My savings will last longer than the rest of the economy if we go on strike." So that's telling you something. You know, who knows how much this individual has saved, but it's unlikely that it would be, you know, more than a
year's
worth.
We get what they're getting at.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, so a strike would have come at an especially awkward moment, political moment for the White House and the Democrats with less than 2 months to go to the midterms. And so that is why the president had put together a specific board to sort of control, to be a part of these negotiations, and, you know, put Labor Secretary Marty Walsh, as well as Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, involved directly in these negotiations to make sure that an outcome came about that would not just completely dash their hopes in the midterms. You know, and so as Elliot had actually mentioned, during the last day of the negotiations, President Joe Biden called in personally to talk to the negotiators to stress how much they needed to come to a deal and try and help them get there. And it seems to have worked. You know, sources within the unions have actually given Biden's call credit for helping to get a deal completed without a strike. And, you know, at a Rose Garden appearance after the tentative deal was announced, President Biden said, quote, "I'm grateful. This agreement is validation of what I've always believed. Unions and management can work together for the benefit of everyone." You know, a fairly bland statement, but also, you know, that it is kind of a departure from where a lot of our previous political leaders and presidents have been, which is actually recognizing the value of unions and them being on an equal footing with the management that they you know, negotiate with. And that has played out, as we've talked before, in the way that Biden's NLRB has also really kind of worked to help a lot of the burgeoning union movement in this country, specifically like at Starbucks and Amazon, help them push back and push the limits of where they thought they could go and actually kind of gain some concessions from management.
Yeah. No, and obviously, you know, I think the White House, like, there's, from a White House perspective, there's no way to look at this as anything other than a victory, as long as rank and file kind of votes the way leadership thinks. But, you know, we don't have all the details of the deal, but ultimately, I think, again, we can get really stuck on wages. And again, to the best knowledge of reporting, employees have also agreed to a 24% wage increase as a part of this deal.
Yeah.
But again, you talk about the one day, like PTO, only approval for medical kind of appointments and things like this. I still think there's a long way to go in terms of kind of creating a fair and balanced working environment for the supply chain as a whole. And, you know, you kind of take a step back and supply chain in itself is really not built with any sort of flexibility in mind.
No.
Which is why we kind of ended up in the situation that we did kind of from a COVID standpoint, right? Like any sort of kind of bump in the road, you know, we're all kind of on it, like, you know, we're all on like an old timey skateboard and like a single rock kind of throws the whole environment into a bad situation. So
yeah,
again, obviously from the president's perspective, this is a gigantic win, a huge win.
Right.
But, you know, from a labor radio here, we're focused more on the worker. And I think there's still a long, long way to go.
Right. Yeah. Like politically, this is a great victory for the Democrats, for the Biden administration. But for the workers, like, this is just the first step.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean,
hopefully, it's kind of something that's going to lead to more down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully, I mean, you know, hopefully this avoids an actual all out strike, because that would be bad for everyone. But at the same time, you know, they are going to have to continue putting pressure on to make sure they actually get more of those demands that they come into the negotiations with.
Yeah. I mean, I think management's, you know, rail management's position of we will let the economy burn before we give you PTO is very clear and evident in that. Also, when you combine that with it, you know, they really gave them like an almost 25% wage increase.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that's going to lead to a lot of extra money, but clearly, in whatever math they've done behind the scenes, the extra headcount required to deal with actual work, like, you know, scheduling that makes sense for the amount of work that they're trying to complete is more than that.
Right.
So they've clearly picked the cheaper option for themselves to kind of move forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, you know, along those lines, actually, you know, a recent analysis of financial filings of the major U.S. rail companies conducted by A More Perfect Union revealed that their windfall profits have come at the direct expense of their workforce. You know, 20 years ago, the four leading American freight carriers earned average operating margins of about 15%. Now their margins are closer to 40%. And, you know, 20 years ago, the four railroads, those companies, spent spent some $8.7 billion on worker compensation and benefits to generate $25 billion. 20 years later, they spend only about 10% more on worker compensation and labor, but their revenue has nearly doubled. And yeah, there'll be more about that in just a moment, but quickly, if you are just tuning in, just joining us, this is Labor Radio, and we are discussing the nearly averted railroad strike and looking at the deal that has been tentatively agreed to between the freight rail companies and the unions representing the conductors and engineers operating those companies' freight rails.
And we should say nearly catastrophic railroad strike, averted railroad strike. Yeah.
Yeah, not just a strike, but also the trickle-down effects would lead to basically a breaking of our supply chain and a dismantling of our economy in a lot of ways. Again, it's not been fully agreed to, but this has certainly been a step in the right direction. Just going back into basically the fact that these companies have, you know, despite the fact that they have been unwilling to really budge that much on concessions to their workers, we've been just sort of discussing how it is that they actually, over the last, you know, couple decades, have really been raking up the profits while, you know, turning down the amount they spend on their workforce. Over the past two decades, the operating profit margins of the major carriers nearly tripled, while the percentage of revenue they spend on labor sunk by double digits. And, you know, like so many other industries, the underlying problem with the railroad companies can really be boiled down to soaring demand coupled with unmitigated corporate greed. I mean, that's kind of the story of America of the late 20th century, but the 21st century. Since the pandemic, cargo volumes obviously have climbed to record highs. Everyone's ordering things online. There's more online shopping and just generally staying at home, people needing more to do than just going out and spending money.
Yeah, I mean, the economy has hugely shifted from services to actual physical goods in like a large, large way. So obviously that would affect kind of all modes of kind of transporting those goods.
Yeah. But over the last 6 years, freight railroads have pared back their workforce by about 30%. To reduce costs and increase profits. They've also been running fewer and longer trains and waiting until those trains are full before letting them leave terminals. So as a result, the railroads have demanded that their workers put in more hours, but given them almost no notice of when those hours are to be worked. Again, sort of, you know, that tails right into what the main grievance of these workers was. More set and consistent schedules with more time off. This industry has also seen increased fuel efficiency. Technology has led to better, you know, more efficiency within the industry, but the reduction of their workforce has clearly had an outsized impact on their operating profit margins. And something that really stood out, the Presidential Emergency Board put together by President Biden to sort of, you know, midwife this negotiation, there's actually a line in their report that explains that, or from, you know, that is the carriers themselves explaining that they believe it is actually their savvy capital investment and risk that are the reasons for their profits and not any contributions by labor. The next line of their quote gives away the game, because they then say, a representative for the carriers then says, the most profitable companies are not those whose worker compensation is the highest. So yeah, you know, sure, it's not the workers, and that's not the labor that's providing value for these companies, but also the companies that are most profitable are the ones that don't pay their workers very well. So, you know, that's kind of mask off in a way, but also it's sort of part and parcel with how most industry treats their workers that are trying to strike or unionize or anything like that. There's a lot more that we could go into statistics-wise about how it is that this industry has really been paring back their workforce and, you know, like they and at the same time increasing their profits. They used to run trains with five worker crews, and that's been brought down to now two worker crews, and they've even expressed a sincere interest in trying to reduce that from two operators in the train just down to one, which again, you know, falls right in line with where most industry is trying to head. Reduce your labor force as like the main way to reduce costs and then invest more in like stock buybacks and stuff like that. In 2000, Union Pacific employed 50,000 people and generated $11 billion in profit, or it, you know, just generated $11 billion. Today, Union Pacific employs 18,000 fewer workers, but manages to earn 85% more in revenue each year. And actually, yeah, the data that has been analyzed by A More Perfect Union suggests that the money once spent on fully staffing locomotives is now spent on enriching shareholders through dividend payments and stock buybacks. And so, you know, that's, again, just exactly in line with where the rest of the industry of this country has gone. But I think that Warren Gunnels, who is the staff director for Senate Budget Committee Chairman Bernie Sanders, tweeted this last week, and I think he put it pretty succinctly, that corporate greed, the example of corporate greed for him is that Warren Buffett, the seventh wealthiest man alive, who is worth $100 billion, became $773 million richer yesterday and $36 billion richer during the pandemic, while rail workers at the company that he owns are getting fired for, you know, quote, the crime of going to the doctor when they're sick. And so, yeah, that sort of sums up the overall issue that's been going on here, which is that these companies have squeezed their workers to get more out of them while making their quality of life less, and at the same time been seeing record profits and soaring profits and executive pay. And all the workers are doing is asking for slightly better working conditions and schedules.
Yeah, and you know, I think this contract runs through 2024, 2025. Yeah. You might have to correct me there. And so this will probably be something that comes back up on the radar to keep an eye on, because obviously this is an essential kind of industry to America, yeah. Right? Both defined by the government and kind of colloquially.
Yeah.
So, you know, we will definitely kind of keep everyone apprised if there are more updates.
Yeah. And just to sort of close out here, like, basically, I think the moral of this story, along with just that corporate greed is never going to be dealt with without a demand, is that this whole situation, you know,